Accession number 27347, Reel 17.
Sandy Brand, Reel 17.
Well, after our exams, there's a notice went up on the board which said all pilots of the 86th pilot's course may now wear the pilot's badge with the following exceptions. And there was a list of half a dozen people who'd failed. And that was the only acknowledgement we got. No pinning of wings on the breast, no fly past, no big parade with a brass hat congratulating us on passing. Nothing like the Americans with squadrons flying overhead and the band playing. With the following exceptions, you can wear the badge. So off we went and sewed up the badge. And then we were given 7 days leave with $25. We were allowed $25 and 7 days leave. Naturally, we headed down to New York. We hitchhiked part of the way. Met some very hospitable Americans who'd been hunting up in Ontario. They had a stag of some sort. I don't know whether it was caribou or moose or what, on the bonnet of the car, draped over and with its feet tied. Taking it home for the deep freeze. They were very hospitable, paid for meals for us on the way. It was quite a drive, and we got to know those chaps pretty well. They were lovely. Anyway, we got down to New York, and we went to the United Services Organization, the USO, who provided for everything. Tickets for the shows, bed and breakfast for us at the YMCA and so on. And there were hosts of young ladies ready and willing to cater for our every needs, I think. And of course they wanted to know what these wings were on our sleeve, because we weren't commissioned. And as ratings, you wear the wings on your right sleeve. When we told them we were pilots, they didn't believe it, because everything was so different in America. Their people were commissioned as soon as they went solo, I think. And then when they did get their wings, it was with a terrific parade, and they're all fully commissioned, and they already had three rows of medals by that time. So these girls didn't believe that we were pilots. So we changed our tack and said that we were carrier pigeon operators first class, and they believed us and accepted us for what we were. Anyway, the time in New York passed very quickly. We saw quite a few shows. I saw Life with Father and things I would never have dreamt of ever achieving in my private life as a boy in Middlesbrough. And then we went back and we were trained up to Moncton, New Brunswick, waiting for a ship back to England. All the RAF boys were commissioned, if they were going to be commissioned, as soon as they got their wings, or they were promoted to sergeant pilot, if that was their end rank. We were still leading naval airmen. I think this was an Admiralty ploy to make sure they didn't have to pay for first class accommodation on the way back. We could be assigned to any old troop ship, accommodated below the waterline, and it saved a lot of money. Typical of the Admiralty. Anyway, we were taken into Halifax, and we were put aboard a new ship, which was the New Mauritania. She looked very much like a miniature Queen Elizabeth with two funnels. The trouble was, she'd just done one run. taking American troops over to the UK, and the blankets and so on that had been used for these troops hadn't been washed. They'd just been thrown in a pile in a corner. They were alive with lice. It was appalling. We were accommodated below the chain locker, up in the bows. No scuttle to open, no fresh air. But worst of all were the toilet arrangements. The toilet arrangements were two wooden battens about 25 feet long with toilet seats screwed or nailed to them at intervals. And these lavatory seats were situated above a wooden trough which ran fore and aft in the ship, with water going in at one end and out with all the effluent at the other end. This was all right for the dockyard matey who'd designed it. He was used to seeing them working perfectly on dock sides, but once you get to sea and you get the motion of the ship, you also get the motions of the people who've been there before you. As the bow went down, you'd get all the contents of the trough go whizzing down the trough, hit the end of the trough and come up like a water spout through the toilet seat nearest the bow. It was absolutely revolting because there was live sewage all over the floor, sculling about with the motion of the ship. Why it hadn't been corrected after the first trip, I do not know. Anyway, it was quite a nightmare. Not only that, they suddenly found that there was salt water in the drinking water tanks, and we were told not to drink any of the water from taps. We were to queue up at some special taps that were arranged where they had condensate, and we had to queue up with a mug, and we're allowed to do that twice a day, two mugs of water. Now, because of the crowds, I'm told there were 12,000 of us aboard the Mauritania. I quite believe it from the congestion that there was. They couldn't cater for hot meals for us. And when we went aboard, we were each issued with packs of... we got packs of 36... dehydrated rations, supposed to have three a day, and it had a warning on the packet that you must drink copious amounts of water because dehydrated rations will constipate you if you don't. Well, we had two mugs a day, and with the toilets in the state that they were, and the food as it was and the shortage of water, I didn't have a motion for 12 days. And when I eventually did have a motion, when I got ashore and took medicine for it, I developed anal fissures where the back passage split in vertical gulfs, which was terribly painful, and they've lasted to this day, and they never get a chance to heal up properly. So being below the chain locker, our first warning that we were going was this terrific clatter as the chain was hoisted in and dropped down into the steel compartment just above us and ahead of us. It smelt terrible. I suppose there was mud from the bottom of Halifax Harbour, which had lain there for centuries without being disturbed. It was a nightmare. In addition, there were a few hammocks which we as Navy types had commandeered, but we'd never used a hammock. But anything rather than sleep on the floor with all this sewage overlap coming out of the heads, the American troops were highly amused. They thought we were doing a Laurel and Hardy stunt by getting in the hammock and falling out the other side. It was real, though. We were not practiced, and we found it difficult, but it wasn't as amusing as the Americans thought it was.
Is there a technique for getting into a hammock that you developed?
It's just habit. You balance, and you spread the hammock so that you can fall into it. We tended to clutch on the other side to leave, and this closed the access to the hammock, and we'd roll over the top of it. We were detailed for clearing tables, at which the RAF air crew had been sitting, and we refused, and we were threatened with a court-martial, but we actually refused to do it, and we said that we're on a similar footing to those people, and in no way would we wait upon them. It caused quite a stir, but we got away with it. I don't know if it went on my records. It probably did. Anyway, we got back to England. We got posted to a place, a receiving camp, which was at the atomic research place, the atomic station up in Bootle in Lancashire. In Lancashire. Bootle, Cumberland, I beg your pardon. Sea scales, and we had a camp there, and we found to our joy that the new CO there was Commander Hawkins, who'd been our senior naval officer at Sealand, and his very pretty Wren secretary too, who'd been promoted and commissioned. She was a wonderful girl. Her strength of character was wonderful. She managed to keep 120 naval airmen at arm's length, which takes some doing. So we stayed there for a few days with lectures. We went down to the firing range and were very impressed by the 15-inch naval gun which was pointing out to sea, and while we were there, one of the charges failed to fire, and I remember them playing hoses on the breech before I think they were afraid that it would go off sometime if they started to open the breech, and it went off, of course it would have been a cannon in reverse. That was quite an experience. Anyway, we got leave from there, and we were sent home. We were sent home with a warrant, a tailor's warrant too, to get our uniform. We had a letter from their lordships of the Admiralty to say that we were commissioned. I forget how much it was. I think it was about £80, which was a fortune in those days. Something of that order, anyway. And we were sent home to stay on leave until we received an appointment to go to the Royal Naval College at Greenwich. The Royal Naval College at Greenwich.
Where did you get your uniform from them?
Well, I, being rather ignorant, I went to a tailor in Middlesbrough without realising that that tailor had always specialised in Merchant Navy uniforms. And when I got my first uniform, it was in a blue serge rather than the sort of doeskin that was favoured by the Royal Navy. And so for a while I was odd man out. I had a serge uniform. Middlesbrough, of course, was the home for Merchant Navy people. The northeast ports all were. And I had every assurance from them that, oh yes, we know all about it, we'll give you special treatment and a special price and all the rest of it. So I was on leave with my new uniform. I think they knocked it together in about 3 or 4 days. In spite of wartime, they of course got an allowance of serge. And then I was greeted with the usual cry, "Hello, you home again? When do you go back?" That was a normal cry. Of course, I had to visit all my aunts in uniform, of course. I had to be taken in to speak to their neighbours, to shown off. And, I had to visit my old school. It was all expected of me. That first leave was taken up entirely with duty calls, I think. Anyway, from there, my first class train travel document down to Greenwich Royal Naval College. Very impressed with the entrance to the college, Queen Anne's buildings, and the painted hall for the dining room was an experience that I'll never forget. But the quarters that we were put in were down in the basement. They were damp. They were typically sort of 18th century cubicles. And where they'd been made for one person, there were two of us with a double bunk, one above the other. Cold water for washing. Typical Navy conditions. But the painted hall for dinner was out of this world. They had Wren girls serving at the table, and they were faultlessly trained. They wore white gloves. Every knife and fork on the table was down to within 3 or 4 millimetres of where it ought to be. And these Wrens could serve plates of soup to about 400 people in something like 15 seconds flat. There were lots of them. But it was an example of what training could do. None of these girls were from well-off families. Most of them were sort of secondary, there weren't secondary modern schools in those days, but there were hardly any of them would be from a secondary school. But they were trained and they knew just what was what. We even had wine with our meals, which was something for the Navy, the Admiralty, to give wine away for nothing. We had the most peculiar lectures while we were there. There was one man who was training us in memory training, and I'm sure that he had Alzheimer's disease. He forgot where he was in the middle of a sentence, and yet he was supposed to be training us in mnemonics and memory joggers and so on. It was absolutely hilarious. He couldn't remember his own name at times, and he was a commander, and this was typical of the standard of lecturers there. So we weren't sorry when it was over. It was supposed to be a knife and fork course to teach us how to behave in a wardroom for ceremonial occasions. Of course, in the Navy, you never knew when you'd be entertaining royalty or foreign ambassadors and people of high rank, and we had to be faultless in our dealings with them. And we used to say that you can't train us in the techniques of eating off a knife and fork. We can balance our peas without dropping them. I'm afraid that we were a different class of people to the ones who'd been trained at the Royal Naval College over the years. We were all Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve people. In some ways we could have taught the RN people a thing or two, but still. The fortnight passed. It was a hardship, and yet it was an experience. I wouldn't have missed it. We had lots of physical exercise, a lot of swimming, anything to keep us fit and anything to tire us out, I think, because the lectures were so dry and uninteresting, mainly historical lectures, that we were glad to get away from it. So back home, after a fortnight, with again a letter saying that we were to stay on leave until we received instructions. I received instructions then to go to Errol up in Scotland. It was an RF station. It was a station which also dealt with delivering aircraft to the Russians. There was a Russian contingent there at the airfield who used to pick up the aircraft and take them to Russia and then come back in one of them, but crowded, and take another batch up. These Russians were kept very much in segregation from us. On the opposite side of the airfield, if we tried to speak to them, the Iron Curtain came down with a terrific clang. The poor Russians were wanting to communicate, but scared to, because amongst them they had their political watchmen.
Roughly when had you arrived at Errol, Stanley? What was it?
That would be in January or February 1944. January 44. I came back from Canada in December, had some leave before Christmas, went to Greenwich. Yes, it would be January 44. And there we were to be trained on swordfish. So it was our introduction to the swordfish. And what a difference to the Harvard. It seemed very primitive to have a fixed undercarriage and fixed pitch propeller. No cabin, no heating, no gun sight, no nothing. a petrol gauge that you couldn't see down below your feet on the tank. With the wind whistling around you all the time. And it was cold that January in Scotland. But it was a good training for what was to come.
Was it a big aircraft?
The Swordfish, yes. It was like sitting in the front seat on the top of a double-decker bus. You were roughly the same height above the ground. But there was still a wing above you, of course. After the Harvard, it seemed very much underpowered. And yet, there was a lovely feeling of lift about it. When you were flying, you knew you were flying. In the Harvard, you tend to feel that you were being dragged through the air. You weren't flying, you were dragged through the air. We were buoyant. And they had a two-seater dual-control swordfish, which was something I never thought would have been necessary. Anyway, we were given dual instruction in a swordfish, which I felt was laughable in a way, because we had our wings. In fact, some of us felt that we could have been instructing.
Did they do the same kind of process then? Did they familiarise you with the swordfish in the way that they've
yes,
done with
the
Tigers and the Harvard?
You had to be careful of doing everything with a hood over you and virtually with your eyes closed. You had to be it had to come as second nature to watch your airspeed and your rate of climb and your engine revs and your oil pressure and so on.
With it though, what level would the training come in at? They wouldn't say, right, can you now fly the straight and level, or would they? Or would they say, just take the aircraft?
No, they gave it to us on the climb out after takeoff. They didn't let us do the first takeoff. On the climb out, just before the turning off the takeoff course, they'd hand over to us. You have control, and then we'd do a climbing turn onto a course, and then go up to a given height. No, most of the time was spent getting the feel of it, doing Chase Me Charlies with another swordfish. Chase Me Charlie is a wonderful thing for getting you to feel your natural reactions. We used to love to get a day with white cumulus clouds, with valleys and cotton wool feeling about it, and we'd chase round there trying to shake the other fella off, and you learned a lot about your aircraft. You learned a lot about your manoeuvring. You had the feel of it, and you knew what you could do and what you shouldn't do. It was impossible to to put the swordfish into a spin. We could stall it, and she would just mush through the air, losing a lot of height, But the nose would drop, however far you had the stick back into your belly, the nose would drop, she'd pick up speed and climb again like a falling leaf. Just like a falling leaf.